This Week in Retronauts, the worst podcast is inside the self. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and here for a mind-bending, DNA-blurring, mitochondrial extravaganza, we have...
Hey, it's Bob Mackey, and I gotta say, God made Parasite Eve, not Parasite Steve.
You know, that joke is a little bit regressive.
I was making fun of regressive opinions.
Ah, okay.
It was satire.
Who are you, Mr. Progress is your middle name?
This is Shane Bettenhausen,
there we go.
OG Parasite Eve fan, big Ayabrea Stan, here excited to talk about.
Don't
say Stan. He can say that, but I can't say Stan?
Okay.
What, because the kids are saying it? It's
yes.
What the kids are saying, T-Frog.
No, it's because it's where it's from.
Get with the times.
It's terrible. Anyway, hi everyone. We're here to talk about Parasite Eve, the 1998 cinematic RPG.
The cinematic RPG.
I stuck 1998. Between the and cinematic, from Squaresoft and Square Electronic Arts, as was happening at the time. And this is actually part of our ongoing Final Fantasy Friends and Family deep dive episode series. We recently did Final Fantasy VII and kind of jumped ahead to Final Fantasy VIII just to take advantage of the Final Fantasy VIII re-release, the remaster. But we do think it's important to talk about Parasite Eve because it did fall between Final Fantasy VII and VIII and is very much a game in the Final Fantasy family. It is very stylistically similar in a lot of ways to Final Fantasy VII and very mechanically similar to Chrono Trigger and comes to us courtesy of some cool people who worked on the Final Fantasy games. And it just feels very much kind of in line with the whole Final Fantasy thing. So before we head along to, I don't know, what, Chrono Cross, Final Fantasy IX, we should look at Parasite Eve because it's 21 years old and that means it's old enough to drink, by God. So let's have a drink. Anyway, yeah, so I kind of gave the basic rundown on the game's first appearance and sort of what it is, but what experience do you guys have with Parasite
Eve? Well, let's,
Shane...
T-Frog, let me interject here. I want to put the listener back in the time.
Uh-oh.
Because this was a really huge time for Square and for Final Fantasy and for JRPGs in general. Like, you know, anybody who's listened to the Final Fantasy VII episode understands that that game was like a pivotal watershed moment in the popularity of Japanese role-playing games in America. Like, I worked at...
And in Europe.
And I worked at retail, and I remember, like, hundreds of people coming in who had never played a Final Fantasy or a JRPG buying it. And most of them actually liking it. Some of them returning it because they couldn't read. But in general, it was a big hit.
So immediately the follow-up was Saga Frontier, and they said, I hate RPGs.
Right. And, like, yeah. And so it looked like there was nothing else in the ilk of, like, serious, high production value,
right. More
adult-oriented.
Well, and then Final Fantasy Tactics came out, and people were like, this is Final Fantasy, but it's weird.
Right, but a lot of us, you know, who were down with FF from before were super excited to see this renaissance for Square and Final Fantasy. And then Parasite Eve was the next thing that got announced that had clearly some of that DNA. Like, obviously, you know, Nomura's art evokes the work he'd done in Final Fantasy VII. You could see that from the key art. Ayabrea looks a bit like characters from Final Fantasy, so you're kind of excited. And also Sakaguchi, the father of Final Fantasy, he is the director of this. Or like,
yeah, you're jumping ahead.
I'm jumping ahead.
So let's talk about where we first experienced
the game. We knew, like I knew, reading in Game Fan, reading in EGM, that like this was coming from not just like some B team at Square.
It was
like
Final Fantasy coming to America. That was the EGM cover.
Right.
With Ayabrea on it.
And are we going to later talk about the idea that Final Fantasy VII was once going to be set in New York City?
We can talk about Hot-Blooded Joe, the detective.
I want to talk about Joe.
Yeah, Hot-Blooded Joe.
Okay.
Not just Joe.
Hot-Blooded Joe.
The detective. So, Shane, you said you worked at retail at the time. So,
yes.
And clearly, as an EGM reader, you were tuned in to the fact that Squaresoft was coming to America with Ayabrea on a black cover.
Yes.
Everything was changing. It was going to be different.
Also, Square's first M-rated title. Also important.
That came to the U.S. Well, I guess it wouldn't have been M-rated in Japan.
Right.
So you were there for it day one.
I imported the Japanese version because I was that excited.
So that was day like negative 300.
Day negative. But like, and you know, we knew that this was kind of a Western adult take on sci-fi fantasy RPG with a little bit of survival horror. Because this is a post, isn't this post Biohazard, post Resident Evil world?
Yeah, Resident Evil had been out for a couple of years. That was 96.
Right. Post RE2.
Post RE2. And even though this is not survival horror, it has a few elements of that genre in it as well.
Yeah, I don't think it could exist without Resident Evil as a predecessor.
And much like post FF7, it has a huge CG pivotal cutscenes that are the thing you remember often when you think about
right,
this game.
Right, sure. Yeah, that's not what I'm... You're jumping ahead in the syllabus again. But I'm just asking, what your first experience with the game was.
But all of this was part of, like, the promotion for this game. You knew you were going to get kind of a thing like Final Fantasy VII. And your first experience is that really importing it, loading it in, that first hour and a half of the game, which much like an FF7 or an FF8 later, kind of knocks the player over the head with, like, a giant set piece with amazing production values and, like, an interesting hybrid combat system that is both action and RPG. So I was instantly super into it.
Okay. Bob, how about you?
I was on the Square train from 1991 onwards.
Wow.
They could do no wrong. Even Saga Frontier I bought, but it didn't divert that train. Didn't derail that train.
It diverted my train.
I was like, that was maybe a series I won't follow anymore. But of course, I was excited about Parasite Eve. It reminded me of Final Fantasy VII. I was excited about an RPG with a modern flair because I like Earthbound. And thankfully, it was a short game, so I could take advantage of GameStop's 3-day return window or 7-day return window even. So I played a lot of games under a week or under 3 days and returned this. So this is one of them. But I really loved it, and I was sad that this was sort of an evolutionary dead end for Square. There were no other cinematic RPGs in the second game, which I did play eventually. Much more recently.
Garbage.
It's a bad action survival game.
It's a totally different game. I would say the evolution of this game, the successor, is Vagrant Story.
Yeah,
which it doesn't have the cinematic sense in the CG, but instead it is cinematic in its presentation. It takes all the CG of Parasite Eve and renders it in real-time graphics and creates a much more consistent worldview. And I don't think there was really any staff in common between the two games, but like the battle system and just the movie-like presentation of Vagrant Story to me says, yes, this is very much the next Parasite Eve, although it's set in, you know, medieval fantasy past as opposed to this year's New York City.
It's funny you say that because I've never really drawn a parallel, but you're right. The basic progression and combat of those two games is on paper similar, but like the insane minutiae of Vagrant Stories, you know, makes it seem so much harder
this
to
is,
me.
This is Parasite Eve is very much a Hollywood action blockbuster video game, whereas Vagrant Story is like HBO miniseries.
Right. But you're right. The way that the player is progressing through the world isn't that different. And it is strange that they didn't use this more. They didn't come up with other things like Parasite Eve. Because really, I mean, to rewind all the way, Parasite Eve was not originally created for this. This is like a sequel to a book, and the author of the book wrote on this story as well. So
I thought I was reading last night when I was researching that Hideki Senna, the author of Parasite Eve, the novel, did not have any direct involvement with the game.
Oh, I read that he did work on the original premise for this.
Someone's wrong, and we're going to get angry letters about it.
I want to say before we go on any further that I wanted to see more games like this, and I didn't appreciate a short RPG at the time, but I feel like the medium limited the form of expression in that an RPG was expected to be a very long game. So this was an outlier, and lots of people liked it, but lots of people hated it because it was a very short game.
I mean, Chrono Trigger is like a 15-hour game. This is like a 10-hour game. And Vagrant Story was originally like a 15-hour game, but Square said, wait a minute, actually people want long RPGs, so they just padded it out into a 30-hour game.
I mean, I'm jumping ahead a bit, but like, you know, I was there. And like, I remember,
you keep doing that.
And I remember thinking that the main story was a little short, but then there is a very replayable kind of new game plus mode we'll get into later that made me feel good about the 6,900 yen I spent on this 20
years
ago.
I have never had a problem with a game that is the right length, that is concise, especially if it gives you incentive to explore it more.
Yeah.
And this game does have a new game plus mode. It also has, within that new game plus mode, an expansive, sprawling dungeon RPG experience. So, you know, I feel like it kind of touches on everything. It's got the best of both worlds. But, you know, if this had been a 40-hour game from the start, it would be so drawn out and so tedious. And I'm glad they didn't do that.
And even though it calls itself an RPG, you only really have one character. And, like, it is not – at the time, we realized, oh, this is not a traditional turn – you know, like traditional turn-based Japanese RPG where you're gathering a huge cast of characters. You know, so I think the survival horror element made me expect a shorter game.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not like the idea of a single protagonist RPG was so bizarre, so out there. I mean, you had games like Brandish or whatever that were action RPGs. Zelda was, you know, sometimes touched on the RPG genre. Symphony of the Night. Like, all these games are single-player kind of action-driven experiences. And they work, single character driven experiences.
Also,
and this was very much in that spirit.
Yeah, this is also the era, you know, peak PS1, where like things such as lavish CG cutscenes that filled the screen, and like great soundtracks that sounded almost like Red Book Audio, just, you know, they weren't, but like, you know, good sounding
soundtracks. Except the opera.
Right, parts of it were. But, like, the production values were like, cutting edge, right? So, like, again, there were very few places you could go in the world of console gaming and see things that looked and sounded like this. Mm-hmm. So it felt like, you know, even though you were getting less experience, it was very high quality.
Mm-hmm. So let's rewind to what you were saying about this being a novel. So Parasite Eve was originally a novel, novella. You know, a lot of Japanese RPGs actually come from that, like Megami Tensei, et cetera. And in this case, it was a science fiction sort of horror novel about – it was called Parasite Eve, written in 1995, published in 1995, about a woman who becomes host to something called Mitochondria Eve. She was a living expression of the will of the symbiotic organisms that live inside all human cells, kind of like midichlorians. And basically a series of weird and kind of gross events results in Mitochondria Eve conceiving a child that will be, quote unquote, the perfect being, a creature that is capable of harnessing its mitochondrial power to alter its DNA at will to adapt to any situation. So basically like Proteus from the X-Men. And I think they ultimately stop that from, like, the ultimate being from coming into existence in the novel. And then this game is essentially – it's not an adaptation of the book. It's more like an unofficial sequel where the events of the book are actually kind of recapped in a later chapter. And they talk about, oh, yeah, back over in Japan, this thing happened. And we narrowly stopped, you know, the extinction of all life on Earth. But now it's happening again here in New York.
Right. And like I read a few different things, whether or not the original author, Sena, had any input in the actual work on the screenplay. And like the book here, you know, actually says the entire screenplay is written by Takashi Tokita, mm-hmm. but it was adapted from, you know, the original mm-hmm. novel. And like, you know, I don't want to spoil things, but like the New Game Plus actually has like a lot more story in it if you ever mm-hmm. finished it. It kind of completes the story well beyond the normal game. And like I think at the time, I remember like shortly after this came out, there was talk of, you know, a feature film being possibly made in America where Madonna's production company had optioned the rights. And maybe Madonna was going to star in a U.S. version of Parasite. I remember being super excited.
I was thinking there was a Madonna connection. I didn't know what it was. But there is a Japanese movie adaptation mm-hmm. of that novel.
Yeah, a few years
way
later.
Different.
A few years later, yeah. But like I remember at the time of Parasite thinking, wouldn't it be cool had Madonna made a Parasite movie?
All right. And so another big thing about Parasite Eve, the game, is that as it says there on the Japanese packaging that you brought in, it is a Square USA Presents game.
Right. So, that is bizarre. Yeah.
So, you know, to understand what that means, Square had been wanting to crack the U.S. market, break into the U.S. market for quite a while. They started up their studio in Redmond during the Super NES era, and that team produced exactly one game, The Secret of Evermore.
Ugh.
And that game is fine. You're being unfair.
So that's Square Soft? Because it's like Square USA. Soft, Square USA.
Square Soft was the Japanese development and publishing studio.
Yeah.
Square USA was the American branch. But that was like the original Square USA was in Seattle or Redmond. And I believe they disbanded after Secret of Evermore. And I might have some of the details here wrong. But as far as I remember, you know, once the team disbanded, they went on to form Big Rain and they created crap, what was that PS1 RPG?
Shadow Madness?
Shadow Madness,
oh
yes.
My God. The less you speak of it, the better.
Yeah, that was kind of a mess.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, sorry. But, you know, Square did not give up on the U.S., and they established a studio in Honolulu and began working with teams in L.A. to do the CG for Final Fantasy VII. Or was it the Hawaiian team?
Right. And then eventually that Hawaiian team went on to make Spirits Within, the right. feature film.
Yeah. Right. So basically they kind of established a new studio in the U.S. And if you look at the credits, like the creative staff, the creative direction comes from Square Japan. But basically all the heavy lifting, the programming, the art design, the CG, everything was rendered, like produced by Square USA. Hmm. And it's all American names and, you know, names not Japanese. Yeah. And so this was very much a collaborative effort. Like, yeah. in a lot of ways, it's kind of the direction that Square would work 20 years later, right. Or, you know, 15 years later in the current generation of consoles, hiring out, you know, studios internationally yeah. to work on things like Final Fantasy 15.
Well, and this is 3 years before Metal Gear Solid 2. And I remember at the time, the idea that the revered Japanese role-playing company was making a game, you know, set in America, kind of celebrating America, having like all these set pieces like the Statue of Liberty. Like at the time, it felt.
You could tell it's America because there's yeah. guns everywhere.
There's guns everywhere. It's all about guns.
You go to the hospital in the lobby, there's ammunition.
Well, and the entire subsystem we'll get into is all like gun fetish mm-hmm. stuff. But like at the time, I remember thinking it was cool that not only was Final Fantasy popular, but Square was making a game for America, kind of for America, set in America with Japanese sensibilities.
So it's called a cinematic RPG because it does have a movie-like quality. Like it really plays up the CG cutscenes, and they're much more consistent and integrated better into the game than Final Fantasy VII's. Like yep. you don't get this weird stylistic change.
It's seamless.
Basically like, I mean, I think there's some really great seamless cutscene integration in FF7 that this game doesn't really do as much. It's much more like here's a game scene, then all of a sudden it cuts and it's movie. But there's not as jarring a visual change.
Yeah, like, there's less running around on top of FMV than there would be in FF8, right? Yeah,
right. And you don't go from like realistic CG characters to digital Popeyes, and then randomly there's a digital Popeye CG scene.
I mean, but I also like this era was one where you could like have this like boffo, insane, over the top CG scene in, you know, in the first hour of the game, and this one, I'm sure we'll get to it, it's Eve's big reveal, but it's insane. Like, at the time, it was just exhilarating. It's like, this is, we'll put the butts in seats. Beautiful, insane CG.
And then we will set those butts on fire
everyone,
with our minds.
Everyone immolates.
but yeah, and it, you know, it is a much shorter RPG than people were accustomed to, but I really wish this had been in a direction that video games had explored. Instead of, you know, people saying, I want a lot of game for my money. I wish people would say, I want good replayable game
yeah.
for my money.
I mean, it's funny because like this premise of like, oh, take, you know, kind of what would have been just a genre film and make a fairly linear game out of it with a little bit of action, a little bit of RPG, it still would work for lots of things today.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I would love to see people revive. But, you know, even though this game sold really well, I feel like it did well enough to, you know, inspire a sequel.
Yeah, it was a hit.
They didn't keep exploring this direction, and I don't know. I don't know exactly what happened.
Well, both the sequels divert so heavily from mm-hmm. the structure and gameplay of this, and yeah. really, I can't point to another game in the last 15 years that's really like this game.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. So the key staff for this game, the creative staff, the leads, were mostly Final Fantasy people. Kind of there's some downtime between Final Fantasy VII and VIII.
Pause. Isn't Tokita like FF3 guy kind of?
Yeah. So you have Hironobu Sakaguchi, the father of Final Fantasy, who had been sort of the director on the series up through 5 and then switched to more of a producer role for 6 and 7 and 8, but was still overseeing everything. And, you know, this is the point where he started to have Hollywood ambitions that would, again, culminate in the Spirits Within, yep. which would culminate in him leaving Square.
Is he the creator of Active Time Battle? Or
no, that is Hiroyuki Ito.
Damn it.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Sakaguchi was the original director of Final Fantasy 1 through 5.
Yeah. Is Tokita the director of Chrono Trigger?
Yes.
I thought so.
We were talking about Sakaguchi.
Also, Blade Fencer or Musashi. Right?
Brave Fencer, yeah.
Brave Fencer.
All right, so yeah, anyway, Sakaguchi was the producer here, so he kind of had the same role that he did on Final Fantasy. The director, who was the, okay, director, story writer, and planner, which in Japanese game development terms means designer, was Takashi Tokita, who was the designer, director on Final Fantasy III, on Final Fantasy IV, on Chrono Trigger. Like, he was heavily involved in...
Hanjuku Hiro.
Yes, of course, we can't forget about
Hanjuku Hiro. He's also a fun guy. Like, when I finally met him later, like, he's not what I expected.
Yeah, yeah. I've interviewed him once. A little while. And it was, I think I've mentioned this on the show, but I interviewed him once, and it was at a bar during GDC where they were, like, Square was just holding an event for the Final Fantasy IV remake, I want to say. And his requirement to interview him was that you did a tequila shot with him. So he was just sitting on this couch just slugging back tequila every 15 minutes anytime a new person came up. And I was like, wow, I feel that tequila. And he was just
He's a character. I would like to talk to him about Parasite Eve one day.
Yeah. But, you know, he was what I learned when I talked to him was that he had a theater background. Mm. And that kind of informed the style of Final Fantasy IV and, the overall vibe. And I think that accounts a lot for the cinematic aspirations of Parasite Eve. Like, he is someone who took sort of visual stage narrative seriously and found it very important. So he was a natural fit for Parasite Eve.
Well, in like the cinematic bent of Parasite Eve, like I didn't bring in the soundtrack, but like the soundtrack almost has like a movie style poster with everyone's names written in, like as if it was a big cinematic film. And I think Square kind of saw this as like marketing it like it was a blockbuster film.
Agreed. So also on the team, you have Tetsuya Nomura, who had kind of risen to prominence with the character designs for Final Fantasy VII.
He'd
been with the company longer.
Yeah, like I think he was just becoming hot.
He was a fresh-faced young kid with a love for zippers and straps.
Everyone is normally dressed in this game, though.
Yes.
Like streetwear.
I feel like Parasite Eve is Nomura's horniest series.
Yeah.
His Final Fantasy characters tend to be pretty, like, they're outlandish in their costumes, but, aside from, like, Lulu showing some cleavage, you don't really get a lot of Nomura kind of feeling his oats. But here, like, Ayabrea is a young, hot, blonde detective who sometimes fights crime without a shirt on.
Well, yeah, like, I have to bring this up. I mean, like, in the key art, like, in the manual, like, I was just looking through the Japanese manual, there's, like, three pieces of key art of Ayabrea, and, like, one of them, she's, like, you know, in, like, a undershirt, kind of, like, one arm up, like, really come hither, and the other one, she is wearing a jacket and nothing on underneath.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at that now. I wasn't sure
holding,
if it was fan art
holding
or not.
Her gun.
No, it's Nomura.
In front of her crotch.
And her pants are unbuttoned.
Her pants are unbuttoned, and she has, like, you know, there's kind of this vacant look. I mean, it's at the time, it was shocking, really. It was, you know, this was 22 years ago, and it was very raw. Yeah.
There's also another one where she's, like, in a black dress and she's sitting on a chair and her one leg is kind of propped up on – it's just floating on air.
Yeah.
You don't actually see what it's connected to. But, yeah, Nomura definitely was like, let's sex appeal this game up.
But she was strong and, like, you know, it wasn't just like cheesecake.
Within the game, you don't get any of that.
Right.
You don't see the shower scenes until Parasite Eve 2.
Right.
Like, in this game, she goes – okay, the game starts out and she's on a date. At the opera.
A blind date.
And everything goes horribly wrong, and her date runs off in panic, and she starts kicking ass, and she doesn't stop kicking ass until the game is over.
Pretty much.
At no point is she, like, helpless. At no point does she, like, freak out and cry and say, oh, God, I can't handle this, or this is so scary.
Yeah,
she's just like, I don't really understand what's happening here. Eve, you're really weird, and this is all, like, mind-blowing, and I don't understand what's happening to me. But I'm going to stop you.
Yeah, she's very tough. She's a cop. At no point does she get scared. You're right. Like, and
she is hot-blooded Joe.
Yeah.
Josephine, maybe.
Well, are you going to get into, like, about her design, though? I was reading that originally Sakaguchi wanted a character with long hair, like a very a long-haired protagonist, and Nomura was a fan of short hair, so they kind of met in the middle. And she has, like, this weird kind of haircut, actually.
Right. She's got a mullet.
She's got a sexy mullet.
It is the 90s, and there is time for regrettable haircuts.
I also recently read that Nomura had considered putting Ayabrea in Kingdom Hearts, but the rest of his staff convinced him to change it to Aerith. And I was thinking how strange it would be had Ayabrea been in Kingdom Hearts.
Well, I think the idea was that part of the game she would be Ayabrea, and then, like, at some point Aerith would come in instead.
All right.
That was what I saw. I don't know. Maybe I misunderstood. Anyway, Nomura did the character designs here, and they're very Nomura-ish, except hornier. Just Aya. Like, the other characters are just Nomura. So the battle designer for this game is Yoshihiko Maekawa, a name that I did not recognize, but he had been at Square for a few years, and this was his last project with Square. Mm-hmm. After this, he was one of the people who established Alpha Dream, and he has been the producer on every single Mario and Luigi game.
Wow.
So the idea of like a visually splendid, action-touched, action-kissed RPG with some real-time elements, that's very much his vibe.
If I think about the way you progress through a Mario and Luigi game, it isn't completely dissimilar to how one progresses through a Parasite video game.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually one of the two directors of Mario RPG. There's a weird connection to Mario RPG from Parasite Eve. Like, it's a weird offshoot because the composer's the same and the battle director is the director of Mario RPG that would later become not Paper Mario, but Mario and Luigi.
How many to Mario RPG was Shimomura? Shimomura didn't do any of the other Mario and Luigi games.
Oh, she does all the Mario and Luigi games. And Paper Mario is different. It's Intelligent Systems and somebody else. But her soundtrack is also much different for those games than this one, too.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we should mention Yoko Shimomura, who composed one of, in my opinion, the all-time great soundtracks here. I feel like the only thing that doesn't hold up are the vocal samples, which are samples of a real opera singer.
Specifically in the opera tunes, not like Somnia Memory, so not the theme song.
No, like where you actually have live vocals, it's great.
I mean, it's better.
It's just the sound sampling capabilities of the PS1 were somewhat limited.
It's way more listenable in 2019, 2020 than FF6. I was just listening to the soundtrack last night. And it is, you can still listen to it. But they're right, those are the weak links. But like at the time, this soundtrack was super ahead of its time.
Oh yeah, I specifically interviewed Shimomura about this. It's been it was when she had first written the main theme for Final Fantasy Versus 13.
Wow,
so probably like 2008,
10 years ago.
Yeah, but I talked to her about this album, and I was like, what was the inspiration for this soundtrack? Because it was so ahead of its time. And she said, we went to the U.S. and spent some time with the L.A. team to work with them.
Did they take you to a dance club or something?
Yeah. She said, while we were there, they took us to a dance club. And she had a hard time putting it into words. She was just like, it was such a strange experience. And I felt very weird being there. And I just channeled that experience into this soundtrack.
Well, it worked because it's kind of all over the place. Like when you go back to it, you kind of imagine what you think it's going to be. Like, the opera and some beats. But like the main theme is actually kind of traditional and sad and beautiful. But then like Aya's theme, the theme of Aya is like much scarier and kind of borrows from like the Halloween soundtrack, but then turns into like a four on the floor banger. Mm-hmm. And then Somnia Memories sounds like a really good like Sade song with like a dub beat. It's amazing stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of ambient sound, a lot of ambient music, very sort of atmospheric. And then you have a lot of sort of drum and bass, electronica, and then
the
you have
music,
the opera stuff, and then you have all these things together at the same time.
Yeah, and some of the dungeon music is really creepy. I was listening to last night, like, kind of sounded like The Knife. It's like, it's really good stuff.
Right, and then you have, like the police station theme, which is more traditional, but it's still a little downbeat. And then you have, like some short musical stings for the cutscenes. I don't know, it goes a lot of places, and it's very inventive and really felt very like ahead of its time, kind of like you'd expect from Yuzo Koshiro or someone.
Yeah,
and to me, this was the soundtrack that really established Shimomura as someone to be reckoned with, which is stupid because she'd already, she was the Street Fighter II composer.
Right.
So she was a legend already. But
I think she benefited from the material because like it was like, you didn't have to make things that sounded like Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest, right? You were like, you're making things for, gritty, dingy America, kind of overrun. It's somber and sad. And like some of it kind of sounds like Silent Hill music at parts even. It's really interesting.
Except it's a year before Silent Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of atypical for her because I now associate her with Kingdom Hearts and Mario and Luigi games, like very bouncy, catchy, lighthearted music.
She's so versatile, though.
Yeah.
She has maybe, of any game composer I can think of, I can't pin down Shimomura. Like, I don't hear something and think, that's Shimomura. Yeah. But that's not because she has no personality. It's because she can just do whatever she needs to do. She can fit the theme, and whatever she does is always going to be great.
Apparently this soundtrack is like a cult classic. They actually reprinted it a few years ago, so it's one to get.
This is one that they really need to do like a live performance of, an arranged version where they actually have, a soprano singing the Eve parts.
Have you heard the remixes album? It's not all great.
I have not heard that yet.
Like, she only remixes a few of the songs. Hers are really good. Not all of them are good, but it's, if you're a fan.
But yeah, great music, and I would love to see them revisited. I mean, they're doing, Chrono Orchestra this fall, so surely we can get Parasite Orchestra. Yeah? No? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there's the LA team, Square USA. They did the heavy lifting on the grunt work for this game and also took Shimomura to a weird club. So I feel like in a lot of ways this game was ahead of its time. And the collaborative nature, like international collaboration, was extremely unusual. You just didn't see this sort of thing happening very often. So it was really cool. And the game, I think, turned out really well and is very memorable. You know, we've done a micro episode on this a long time, a few years back, but it was like 10 minutes long. And I feel like this game definitely deserves more exploration than that because it is such an interesting, if somewhat dead end to the RPG format. It's still a unique take and stands apart. So, Parasite Eve is a story-driven cinematic RPG, and a story is nothing without its characters. So let's go briefly through the characters. We've talked a bit about Aya Brea, but she is a police detective with a dead sister and hyperactive mitochondria. That is the essence of Aya Brea right there.
Well, but, and there's clearly something different about Aya Brea because unlike everybody else, she's not bursting into flame.
Yeah, so the game begins with her at the on her date at the opera.
Blind date.
And the blind date. Suddenly the singer, the diva,
the soprano,
freaks out.
The diva.
Yeah, and everyone explodes into fire except Aya.
Yes.
And so she stands up, and because she's a tough cop lady, she has, you know, she's wearing her little black dress, but she also has a thigh holster. Right.
And
thigh
the, you know, the soprano singer has morphed into this hideous monstrosity called Eve,
mm-hmm. which is with very long arms and
yes.
fingers.
Yes.
So the monstrosity is Melissa Pierce, the opera singer, and she becomes Eve, the manifestation once again of mitochondrial evolutionary potential.
Spoiler alert, maybe this is a result of someone's hubris thinking they could save their wife after a car accident and doing an experimental medical procedure on her mitochondria.
How Mr. Freeze. The real Mr. Freeze story. I will say, like, the characters in this story are all very stock
yes.
and very Hollywood types, but it was fun to see them in the context of a JRPG.
Mm-hmm. And eventually, Eve gives birth to a super baby, not like in Metal Gear Solid, just
the ultimate
a
being.
Baby that flies around because it is superior.
This is like, you fast forwarded, we're like, you know, we've gone to the opera house, she's taken over the Statue of Liberty, the super baby's born. You're at the end of the game now.
Yeah. I spoiled it. All 8 hours of it.
But there's a lot of other cops and people helping
right.
her with their guns, some mm-hmm. supporting cast.
Yeah, there's Daniel Dallas,
her
who
boss.
Is her boss. He's kind of the Murtaugh to Aya's Riggs.
And doesn't he have a cute kid who gets
yes.
in trouble and just go rescue
Ben,
him?
Yeah. Ben.
Young Ben.
His ex-wife dies horribly in Central Park. She becomes part of the LCL blob.
Right. There's like a giant, massive, like mutated humanity running around town.
Yeah,
which eventually
trying to poison the water supply.
Well, and that's eventually what helps give birth to the ultimate creature mm-hmm. at the end there.
Yep. So Daniel Dallas' ex-wife is Super Baby's midwife?
Well, and I remember at the time, I liked that like shit gets real. Like at the beginning of the game, it's like, you know, New York City is fucked throughout. It's a disaster.
They evacuate the city on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
That's hardcore.
You know, this is a good Christmas.
Although, actually, you know,
this is a good Christmas game.
Actually, you know, I haven't been to New York on Christmas, but I've been there on Thanksgiving, and it is kind of like playing Parasite Eve. Like, no one is in New York City on Thanksgiving. I'm like, wow, the streets are empty. What's going on?
I had a Parasite Eve experience, and I was just in Seattle for PAX. And we know someone who works at the Paramount Theater, which was opened in like 1928. And we got a tour of the behind the scenes of the theater. And I was just thinking of the opening of Parasite Eve just alone in an old sort of, you know, stage theater. All the back alleys, all the
was
rooms
there good
full
music,
of junk.
Though?
No, it was eerily silent.
Oh, you needed some. Eerily
silent.
I had a Parasite Eve experience at PAX too in 2009. I got swine flu.
Oh yeah, I was just.
I got swine flu from a beanbag.
From a beanbag.
Did you eat the beanbag?
No, I just sat on it. But then I was telling that.
Don't lick it.
I was telling that story this year at PAX. Someone went up me. They're like, my friend got a flesh-eating bacteria at PAX.
Whoa!
Is that the entire
Parasite
why
Eve?
I don't sleep with people at PAX?
The entire room with all the beanbag chairs in it.
It's just basically a petri dish.
Yeah, it's a disease farm. Yeah. Don't lay down there.
Don't ever go over there. Yeah, I remember 2009 very well because my wife got swine flu while she was on a tour of the country photographing hotels and stuff. Oof. For a freelance company, like a company that she was freelancing
for. Wash your hands, Retronauts listeners.
But also, I got back from PAX and I was fine, but then I had to go to a Halo ODST review session with David Ellis, who picked up the swine flu at PAX.
Jesus.
So he was like sitting there right next to me recording video footage while I was trying to review ODST. And I was like, I don't want to die. Please don't breathe on me. Anyway, Parasite Eve.
Iabrea, she didn't have to worry about that.
So Daniel Dallas is kind of like the more buttoned down version of Barrett Wallace. You know, African-American, single father, hot-headed, but ultimately a good guy, reliable, and fights for what's right. I feel like they were very – like they were kind of stamped from the same mold. Mm-hmm. And it was actually very unusual to see single father – like African-American fathers in entertainment media. It's still uncommon.
22 years ago.
Yeah. Like you just don't see that very often. So, you know, whatever mishandling they might have had from not being culturally aware necessarily issues there, he's a great guy.
And he is one of the main characters. And like you kind of need the son to be like this, you know, distress – thing to be in distress later in the game.
Yeah.
Because you know? Aya doesn't really have close relationships.
No, she's kind of aloof. Yeah. She's a nice enough lady, but she's not really close to anyone. Yeah. And like when her blind date runs off in a panic, she's like, whatever. Yeah.
There aren't a lot of characters in this game, but there are also more people at the police station that aren't given key art or anything, but they are given strong enough personalities that you know who they are.
Yeah, and then you have at the police station, you have Owens and Garcia.
Yeah.
So they do have some key art.
Yeah, oh, they do? Okay.
They have
just like headshots.
They have no more art. And they're kind of like they feel like film characters. They're like these kind of wisecracking guys who help you with your guns.
Right. And then one of them dies and you feel bad for them.
Spoilers.
And one of them is extremely into gun safety. Mm-hmm. That is the Japanese writer coming through saying like, hey, guns are actually kind of bad. If you're going to have a gun, be really responsible. Don't leave your ammunition sitting around in the hotel lobby, et cetera.
It's true.
And then finally, the other like really important character is Kunihiko Maeda, who I feel is meant to be sort of the POV character. Mm-hmm. He is a Japanese scientist. He's kind of like nervous and bumbling, but he knows a lot about the mitochondria stuff and is critical to kind of explaining the backstory and the, you know, drawing the line to the original Parasite Eve, the novel. And so he plays a kind of a crucial backup role.
He explains everything.
Really a shame that they turned him into just like a simpering pervert in The Third Birthday.
Oh, God.
But there's a lot of things that The Third Birthday did wrong.
I mean, if you get to the very end, there's Aya's sister, Maya. Was her name like Maya?
Aya and Maya. And that was her twin sister who was killed in a car accident. And Aya, I think, got her eye.
Yes.
It's like she lost her eye in the accident and was given Maya's eye as a replacement. And so she, like, sees visions of things that Maya saw. And apparently Maya was the host for Mitochondria Eve or something.
She was, like, the perfect one or something.
Yeah.
Right?
And so, like, the integration of her biology into Aya's biology is what gives Aya the ability to unlock mitochondria. And that is what sets Aya Brea apart from other police detectives in that she can control her mitochondria, but not in an evil, horrible way like Eve. More like in an RPG skill kind of way.
Right.
She has a skill system. It's very much like Dragon Quest skills or even Chrono Trigger, where at set levels, she gains new powers and they are very finite and specific, but they are, you know, using her mitochondria to do things like heal
or defend
or go faster.
Yeah. Actually, and then, you know, the combat is interesting because, again, it's a weird mix of active time battle and running around issuing commands.
Yeah, I can't remember what they call the battle system in this. It's probably like Active Time Battle 3.0 or something.
Right.
But it feels like kind of an evolution of Chrono Trigger, which is an evolution of Final Fantasy, in that, you know, you do have the Active Time Battle meter that fills up. And once it does, then you can perform an action. But in the meantime, you can run around freely.
Within a circle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's like
within – basically you can run around on the screen. But the thing is, like, there's some positioning elements to this. Like, enemies have a certain range, and also your actions have a certain range. When your turn comes up and you bring up the command prompt, that's when it kind of takes on its own personality, and it brings up this sphere that surrounds Aya, and you can perform actions and attack enemies within this sphere. Mm-hmm. So you're kind
and
of like
the weapon
around
you have equipped as well.
Right.
Right.
Yes, the weapon range and so forth. Yeah. But also, like, your skills are kind of based on that too. So you can target any enemy within this sphere.
And some weapons can attack multiple enemies too.
Right. Yeah. But again, this is very similar to Vagrant Story, except you can't really target individual parts of most enemies. I think there's some bosses where you can target like left leg, right leg. But, you know, this would evolve in Vagrant Story so that you're not just targeting an enemy, but you're saying like, oh, I want to attack this body part and debilitate it so it can't run.
Yeah, I feel like that I'm not sure what their philosophy was, but I feel like this game was meant to reach non-RPG players or to – if you bought Final Fantasy VII and you didn't play RPGs, you'd be like, what is even happening? But I feel like if you bought this and didn't play RPGs, you'd be like, oh, well, I can figure this out at least because it's simple
enough.
Because
you can still run around.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Right.
So you can't just like – if you look at the Final Fantasy VII remake, you can run around in battle and just like spam the attack button. Here you can't do that. You have to wait until your ATB meter fills up, and then you can take an action.
Mm-hmm. It's a bit like Grandia 2-ish.
Yeah, but before Grandia 2.
Before
Grandia had a
similar
combat
as well. Yeah. But you know, it definitely felt different. Like there was a continuity from FF7, but like it felt easier and more pared down for sure.
Yeah, I was struck by how simple it was. I didn't think it was bad, but I replayed this about 5 years ago. I was like, oh, it is pretty simple. Like,
It is definitely taking that Chrono Trigger style and giving you the ability to run around between actions. But, you know, Chrono Trigger was very much about, like, simplifying the Final Fantasy concept to be more like Dragon Quest and kind of striking a happy balance. And this does that, but instead of having a party, you just have one character. So you kind of have to balance, like, do I want to attack with a gun or use a parasite power or, like, a mitochondria power here or what?
Were there melee attacks or weapons
really
in this?
No, she did have a baton.
I thought so, yeah.
But she has a baton. It's very weak.
And, like, you know, my memories of this were that, like, it wasn't very difficult to use this game systems to power up my gun to where normal combat would be fun and easy. And then bosses were strategic and difficult. But in general, like, the regular combat was fun. I didn't feel bad about it. You know, you kind of wanted to grind, and we'll get to the EX game, New Game Plus later, but like, depending on what weapons you did and what you did to your guns, you could actually make very powerful implements.
Yeah, that was kind of the core power-up system. You could find different guns throughout the game, and then you could modify those guns, and each of them had like equipment slots, kind of like the weapons in Final Fantasy VII, but instead of just like putting spells on them, you were putting modifiers, like you can shoot different kinds of rounds, like you can shoot acid rounds. Or you can extend the magazine.
Or you can hit multiple enemies.
Or you can extend the range. Or get multiple shots against a single enemy. So you had a lot of options that you could find and customize your weapons. And, you know, at the end you're getting like a rocket launcher. But do you want to use the rocket launcher because it only has one shot per round? Do you want to, you know, stick with a Beretta or something, which is going to have more bullets? So, you kind of had to figure that out. It was considering how simple the game is, it gives you a lot of options within
a fairly small rubric.
Yeah.
You mentioned Chrono Trigger, and I remember that game. There was no – so your movement and your location did matter occasionally, but there was no real way to intentionally move to a certain spot. And I feel like this was them saying, let's do that for people, and let's make location and movement a part of the system when we couldn't before.
Yeah, Chrono Trigger, you would like – kind of just automatically jump into a spot, and there are some skills that would like hit all enemies in a line. But if you were not lined up with the enemies, you couldn't get anything out of it.
Yeah, it felt more luck based, just like, oh, I happen to be in this spot to attack this enemy, or they happen to be in this, you know, sort of arrangement.
Yeah, and that was fine because it was kind of like recognizing an opportunity and seizing it, but you couldn't manipulate the game very easily to give you that. Whereas this was much more that way. And so you did have some positioning, some freedom to do that. So the game kind of works in a Final Fantasy style in terms of the environmental presentation. It's a lot of pre-rendered, you know, illustrated static backgrounds with some minor animation in them, all sort of linked together. The presentation tends to be a lot more cinematic in that it has tighter, closer shots. There are very few areas where you see kind of zoomed back, like Central Park and maybe one or two other spaces.
Right.
But for the most part, it's
pretty
it's much closer.
In.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember thinking that I kind of like liked these pre-rendered backgrounds better than a lot of FF7s because they were lavish and, you know, by the time you get to the Statue of Liberty or like the Opera House, they're very, very pretty and, you know, great art direction. And because it's trying to recreate reality and doing a fairly good job of it with pre-renders, I kind of liked it better. Because, you know, obviously I at this era, I really was sad that we weren't getting real-time graphics. It would take a long time for, like, you know, real-time graphics to match the pre-render. But, like, I felt like Parasite Eve visually did a good job, and I feel like it like of that era, it's one of my favorite use of render graphics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really nice.
The backgrounds remind me more of FF7 than 8 in that they're more cluttered and more about replicating the filth and dirt and just disorder of the world. And 8 was a little more, I mean, there were areas like that, but it was more like here's a pristine city, or here's like a nice vista, or here's a place you'd want to visit, where Midgar and other areas in FF7 were much like New York in this game. Just like piles of things, trash, griminess.
Right, and kind of getting back to the connection between Final Fantasy VII and Parasite Eve, we mentioned Hot-Blooded Detective Joe earlier, and that was kind of the original concept for Final Fantasy VII, was that it would be set in New York City and would star a detective, and that obviously didn't happen. Hot-Blooded Joe became Cloud, and New York City became Midgar. But then you have this, which is basically sort of a regurgitation of those concepts and them saying, like, hey, let's do this in a game that is actually makes sense.
I love it when, like, they won't let go of an idea and it comes back in a different fashion. And you kind of see what could have been.
Yeah, so it works out really well. Another similarity to Chrono Trigger is that there are no random encounters in this game.
Right.
As you're running through the environments, there are trigger points that you'll cross over. So you can keep tripping those encounters at those points, but you're never going to be blindsided. You're always going to know, like, you know, once you get a feel for the area, like, you're going to encounter monsters here. So it's all kind of structured and set, which, you know, in some people's opinion might be bad because it's just like, well, you know,
you can't grind as much.
Yeah, and, you know, there's no surprise, there's no randomness. But I do appreciate the fact that also, like in Chrono Trigger, there's no separate scene for a battle. When you encounter enemies, you are fighting them in that space.
Yeah.
And that's something that you know, Final Fantasy games still don't really do outside of the MMOs.
But there also aren't a finite amount of battles. You can grind if you want
to. You
can return
grind
to spots.
But there, it's always like, you know, you're going to be fighting an alligator and a crow here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's fine. Oh, one thing that I really like about this game is the way that it has a hub. And you don't really see that a lot in RPGs of this era, the idea of having a persistent space that is kind of safe for you. And, you know, it is kind of driven by story. Like, you go back to it at certain times, and there are some times when you can't go back to it. But it does kind of bring back the style of something like Wizardry, you know, that kind of classic dungeon RPG where there's a town that you go to, and you use that as your home base, and that's where you stock up, and that's where you rest, and that's where you buy new weapons and that sort of thing. And it's the police station here. You have those guys who are...
And it makes sense, like, diegetically. You're a police officer. You're investigating these things.
You got to go back and file a report.
Yeah.
That's what you got to do. And then, you know, Wayne's going to upgrade your weapon and then lecture you about it. So I feel like that kind of goes through the fundamentals. So let's give a brief rundown of the story, which takes place in Christmas 1998. Remember when New York City was abandoned in Christmas 1998?
I remember that year. Good year.
Yeah.
Actually, post 9/11, the view of a tragedy in NYC is very whimsical in this game.
Yeah. Like, the city just kind of clears out automatically. Everyone's like, oh, we got to get going. But basically, it starts on Christmas Eve, and Aya goes on a date to the opera.
Also,
everything goes horrible.
Pause. I mean, like, you know, I'm a swinging bachelor, but like blind date on Christmas Eve? I mean, that's a lot.
I feel like Christmas being a romantic holiday is more of a way more of a Japanese thing.
Right. You know, that's true.
Anyway, the date goes horribly wrong because everyone in the theater bursts into flames.
Merry Christmas.
So she decides, I'm going to gun down this horrible opera singer who caused everyone to die. And she chases her backstage. And there's a little bit of like survival horror, you know, key hunting, like pixel hunting for items in the back rooms. But there's also some sort of diegetic narrative where you find notes and things like that. So it's definitely kind of picking up the Resident Evil thing. You're fighting mutated rats and things like that in the backstage.
And the first cutscene of a rat getting mutated is body horror disgusting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like its body ripples and bulges and it explodes into this horrible
monster. Enemy design throughout is pretty grotesque, I'll say.
Yep.
It's a pre-Silent Hill as well.
Yep. So anyway, she tracks down Eve and there's a fight, but then Eve runs off and is like, ha ha ha, I'm the villain. So that's it for day one. Aya goes back outside and the police are wow, everyone's dead except you. That's weird.
I remember at the time thinking it's interesting again, like both the protagonist and antagonist, like strong female characters, like female heroine, female evil throughout the whole game, which is, you know, again, unique at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the next day, Christmas, there's a press conference, which, you know, happens all the time on Christmas Day. And Aya spills the beans about Eve. And decides to go visit a scientist, Maeda. No. It's a different scientist, right?
The first one, yeah.
It's Krauss or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
The clearly evil one at the Museum of Natural History, which, by the way, has the best exhibition ever. It's a chocobo exhibition.
Right.
I love that, yeah.
Also, like, we're going to skip ahead, but, like, you know, there's a giant, like, dinosaur skeleton, which ends up, you end up fighting. But this is also post-Jurassic Park. Dinosaurs are still really cool.
Yeah. Wait, dinosaurs are not really cool now?
Well, not really.
They were really cool in the 90s.
They're birds. Bob, I thought you loved birds.
I do, but I mean, we're in the post-Jurassic World era now. So.
Oh, right. They're Chris Pratt. Chris Pratt.
Yeah, like, he's one of the 15 Hollywood Chrises.
Chris Pratt sucks. Jurassic World suck. Yeah. Dinosaurs were cooler in the 90s. Come on.
Okay, they were. There was even a TV series called Dinosaurs.
Yep. I'm the baby. Not the baby?
Anyway, a lot happens on Christmas Day. There's a concert in Central Park. And people go to that because that's what they do on Christmas Day, I guess.
Day, yeah.
And everyone there turns into LCL from Neon Genesis Evangelion.
And it's pretty upsetting.
They melt into a blob. Except Ben Dallas. For some reason, he survives.
A day after a tragedy at a concert, people go to another concert in the same city.
Yes.
Yeah. And
after lightning strikes twice, although not lightning from Final Fantasy, people are like, hey, actually, maybe this is bad. So Manhattan is evacuated, and it's clean and painless, and the city totally empties out because that's exactly how it would go in
real
life.
Very easy.
But there is a really cool scene on day two where Aya and Eve battle once again on the back of a horse-drawn carriage.
Oh, I forgot about that
Which
part.
Is like straight out of Castlevania Rondo of Blood. Like she needs to launch a giant skull.
Is that
at
in
Aya.
Central Park where that's happening?
I think it's on the streets surrounding Central Park, but you know, Central Park's really big, so
it is.
There's a lot of road, but it's running past Jerry Seinfeld's apartment or whatever. Day three, that's when Maeda comes into the plot, and he provides a synopsis of the novel, and then Eve blows up the police station.
Yeah, he knows, like, how Eve got made from the scientist who tried to bring his wife back. Mm-hmm.
But the attack on the police station reminds me a lot of one of the Terminator movies. Is it Terminator
2?
Yeah, like, I feel like it was very inspired by that. They said, let's make a Hollywood movie. What is one of the biggest Hollywood movies ever? We got Jurassic Park and we got Terminator 2.
The repercussions of T2 were still being felt 10 years later.
So day four is maybe the first time the word sperm was ever used in an RPG.
That shocked me. It's like so much talk about sperm. I'm 16 years old playing this video
she
game.
She is going to the clinic to steal the sperm. You must stop her.
It's pretty wild. Yeah, Eve wants to get pregnant and... I guess, you know, she just, like, cuts out the middleman and the man altogether.
Yeah, she
just,
she just wants to talk to a man.
She just
wants the sperm.
She steals the sperm,
goes to the Statue of Liberty.
Aya chases after her and is like, whoa, I'm tied up in all of this too. My sister is dead and that's important. But yeah, then there's the – no, actually the Statue of Liberty is the next day.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, day four is there's a big fight on top of the hospital.
You fight a scorpion or a spider on top of the hospital.
Yes.
And what annoys me about this game slightly is that there are like two quick time events that are instant death unless you know exactly what you have to do.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And it feels like they were trying to add action elements, but the punishment is way too great. Like there's a final scene where something is chasing you, but this one is
Is it a game over if you fail?
There's
two jet fighters that come in to attack Eve. And she like flies up and kills the pilots.
Yeah.
And so their planes crash into the hospital buildings.
Wow.
Airplanes crashing into a couple of towers in New York City.
It seems rough. It seemed like a good time.
I forgot
about these parts because I replayed the first hour last night, but I didn't get deep into it because it's been 20 years. But like those QTEs, that was very of the era.
Yeah. And so if you do not escape the roof on time and do the proper QTE, then you're still on the rooftop when the planes crash into the hospital. You explode in a fiery ball of death.
It can be hard to read the backgrounds at times. And also, I don't think you're signaled well enough to let you know, like, you will die and have to reload a save if you do not get out of here. So.
Yeah, it doesn't fit very well. But there's only a couple of these missteps. And once you die once and have to fight the scorpion again, you're like, okay.
Well, and I think in that era, that was kind of seen as a fun gameplay mechanic, because other games had this in the 90s and like not so much anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right, so day five, that's when you get the Statue of Liberty. Straight out of Ghostbusters 2, comes to life, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It gets like, kind of mutated broken and like – yeah.
Well,
like,
that massive LCL from day two, the Christmas mass.
She brings it there.
It's still just throbbing around in New York City and finally decides, I'm going to go infect the water supply and turn everyone in New York City, which is abandoned, into me. But she stops it from getting into the water supply. But then at the end, she fights Eve again. And it turns out now Eve is pregnant and has like 20 breasts and is just like huge and weird and like
about to give
super
birth to
creepy
the
body
being.
Horror. Yeah. And so then the blob comes and protects her, like shields her and takes her away so that she can give birth to a baby. The flying baby, the ultimate being, which is born and attacks Aya on a ship off the coast.
Over by Staten Island?
Yeah, sure. So anyway, Aya's like, the only way to kill a baby is to blow up an entire ship. And that's what she does.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a big fight, and by this point, Aya knows her Liberate skills, so the fight is basically cake, because Liberate is basically instant win.
It's like Omni-Slash.
Yeah, pretty much. Sephiroth. Yeah, basically. Like, you activate Liberate, and you're super powerful and have high defense and can use, like, I think a beam attack.
I mean, is the premise that she has, like, managed to comprehend the mitochondrial
power? She's gone
power and
SSJ level 9.
Right. Yeah. She's, like, and she somehow, like, you know, purified herself of the evil of it and control it. Yeah.
And then the slime baby chases you.
Yep.
And you have to know which way to go or it's game over.
Yep.
Again. Once again.
But you blow up the ship and you save the world. And then Maeda says, perhaps it is we who are the parasites.
Mm.
And it makes you think. It really makes you
but
think.
But is it really over? No.
No. Because then there's New Game Plus.
Chrysler Building.
New Game Plus allows you to take all the cool stuff you did to your gun and your good armor, your body armor, because militarized police
but
is cool.
Starting over at level one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but you have like kick-ass gun with acid shots and like, you know, multi-burst and really great body armor.
How far
so
can
those,
you get?
So those little rat dudes are no challenge whatsoever. Yeah. Alligators, I laugh at them. So yes, after a few days into the game, the New Game Plus mode, the Chrysler Building in the center of New York City in downtown, Midtown, opens up and you can go in there and it is 77 floors, just like the real Chrysler Building, randomly generated floors. And every 10 stages, you fight a boss, or every 10 floors, you fight a boss and you can save.
And also, this is 1998. Like, Shiren the Wanderer style games aren't exactly popular in America.
No, but Squared had been exploring this kind of idea with Tobal.
And Tobal and Chocobo. Mm-hmm. Chocobo Materia Engine come out?
Yeah. The first one had come out in Japan. The second one, which came out in the US, I don't think was out.
Tobal number one had a little bit of this. But, like, yeah, at the time, like, I knew that this type of game, a randomly generated roguelike thing was a thing in
Japan.
There's
also Lufia 2.
Lufia 2 had it as well. But like this was one of the first ones that I experienced. And I actually, because that first playthrough, Parasite Eve 1, was a little short, I wanted more. And I actually did play a sizable amount of the Chrysler Building back in the day.
I honestly never really spent that much time with it, and I wish I had because that's kind of my jam.
Yeah, that's kind of your
like,
jam.
Yeah, yeah, like, you know, dungeon crawling and
an Art Deco building.
And an excuse to just, like, not worry about the story and focus on a great combat system and fight my way through difficult bosses and battles. That sounds great. And then at the top, you do ultimately fight, like, the ultimate version of Eve.
Maya.
Who is your sister Maya, who is dead but actually not. And if you can defeat Eve, then Maya is able to overcome Eve's influence on her body. And basically you get the good ending where Maya, like, purges Eve, basically. And Aya basically purges her own mitochondria power. And so they go off and, you know, Maya and Aya can be sisters and live happily ever after together again.
Yeah, it was cool. And it was, like, at that time, one of the first New Game Pluses like that that I had seen.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Chrono Trigger had New Game Plus, and so, you know, you've got the direct carryover because there was Chrono Trigger staff here. But this, yeah, like, putting an entirely new aspect, like, basically doubling the content of the game in New Game Plus was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was still a fairly new idea. I think now any game you expect New Game Plus, even an action game, where it's like, well, of course I'll be able to play through it again with all my stuff, right? Now, but then it was like, here's a new idea we're playing with. Let's see what we could do with it. Mm-hmm. So it was fun to see that.
Yeah, so very, very kind of groundbreaking. And I think the game reviewed pretty well back in the day. I don't think it got, you know, Final Fantasy scores.
Yeah, but like but eights yeah. a few nines, you know.
Yeah, people. Yeah. I think people complained, oh, it's too short. But it's really cool and, you know, distinct and makes – it's a very striking game.
I think, you know, putting myself back in that headspace, it gave me the idea that, oh, wow, we're going to see a lot of these new IPs from Square. They're going to, like, come and do new things post-Final Fantasy VII. We're going to, like – and there weren't as many as I – there weren't a lot of new things like Parasite Eve after Parasite Eve.
There was Vagrant Story, basically.
Even and Brave Fencer.
Is Brave Fencer that much like Parasite Eve, though?
I mean, it's a new IP that they're trying to develop. Yeah,
yeah, and like the first one did feel like it would be a larger franchise than it ended up being. But Parasite Eve just feels so serious and so Western focused, and there was really nothing else like that. Maybe, I mean, you could say the Bouncer could have been that, but like, that's has there been an episode of the Bouncer on the Retronauts?
Definitely not.
Well, but I'll say is you know it is the same in that like you had this idea it was going to be something long and it was something very short. I mean, like a fourth the length of Parasite Eve. But, like, yeah, Parasite Eve, the fact that Parasite Eve 2 was not the direct sequel it should have been, I think kind of damaged the future of the franchise. Mm-hmm. I mean, we won't get into Parasite Eve 2 too much here, but, like, had it had the same combat system as Parasite Eve 1, I think maybe we'd still be playing more Parasite Eve games now today.
Maybe. At the very least, if it weren't a mediocre survival horror game, we'd be playing more Parasite Eve games.
Yeah.
We did eventually get a third game, the third birthday.
Well,
which,
it was a long path because it was originally announced as a mobile-only game.
It was a mobile game, and it focused on, like, the trailer for that, the preview, for some reason focused on Aya Brea getting married, and that doesn't actually happen in Parasite Eve, the third birthday.
And covered in blood or something?
Yeah, like, that becomes part of the backstory.
Yeah, but this game does not have the license of Parasite Eve, which is why it's called the third birthday, which is, I don't know if that was a choice or they didn't want to pay for it or the author didn't want
that. The original author had the rights and the games didn't come out on digital until like 2010 because he had the rights and they finally got them the rights back.
Seems like a mess. But all I remember is that you told me to not play it because your clothes get shot off. It's a major mechanic in the game.
Yeah, I said that Parasite Eve was peak Nomura horniness.
I thought it was a Toriyama guy.
But this is like, well, the artwork, there's a lot of horny Nomura artwork, but Toriyama.
Not Akira.
No.
But the Final Fantasy 13 Lightning
Motomu
superfan.
Toriyama.
Yeah.
Is he the director of Their Birthday?
No, he was the writer and, he was the writer. The director was Tabata.
Yeah, yeah.
Final
now
Fantasy 15.
Off making LARPs, I think.
But I seem to recall that Tabata was not the one responsible for the clothes destruction mechanic.
Outside of the clothes falling off, is it decent? I need to revisit it.
Yeah, it's okay. It kind of is like third-person shooter version of Omicron, The Nomad Soul.
I love David Bowie.
There's no David Bowie, but you – or is it Messiah? It's the game where you can, like, take over
Messiah.
Enemies. Okay, Messiah.
Yeah. But don't they also, like, de-age her within the story?
So, I mean, so actually
– I want to say this era was the era of a lot of really super horny PSP games for some reason.
Yeah, and so I'm going to go ahead and spoil this.
Go for it.
Please spoil it.
Iabrea in The Third Birthday is not Iabrea. Iabrea died.
What?
And she is actually the force responsible for all the monsters that keep spawning around. Like, Aya's.
Wait, our Iabrea?
Yes, our Iabrea, her tormented soul, is causing an incursion of these monsters into New York City and then the world.
Not my Iabrea.
Tower of Babels, yes, our Iabrea. And it turns out Aya in the game is actually Aya's body with the soul of Maya. So she's like a woman having her clothes shot off, but she's in her mind. She's 9 years old.
It's funny because while we were talking,
it's like the opposite of the Fire Emblem characters that look 9 but are actually 1,000 years old. She looks 25, but actually she's 9.
Does that make it less creepy? I don't know. But so we were
it's
talking,
still creepy.
We were talking about Iabrea, and I looked her up on Wikia really quick just to see like stats about her. It's like 1972 to 2010. I'm like, wait, she died?
Yes.
Yeah.
She died for reals.
Huh. Well, you've actually made me slightly curious to revisit Third Birthday.
Okay, so as a game, The Third Birthday is a third-person shooter, and basically you control Aya / Maya, and you are fighting these demonic monster incursion things. So you don't actually control Aya. What happens is you're like using some sort of weird time travel machine that sends Aya's mind into the bodies of people who were at the events. So at any point, you can like target another person who's like a combatant, like an AI character, and take over them,
weird.
Take over their body.
It's a Geist.
Yeah, kind of. But you know, it's only
can't
combatant
characters.
Can't take
over a bowl of dog food.
You can't take over anything except combatants, like army soldiers.
Weird.
Yeah, and each character has, like, you know, a different weapons loadout and that sort of thing.
But none of that's not what I want from Parasite Eve.
No, it's kind of a strange game. Like, I think it works well as a, you know, kind of like a portable third-person shooter, but then you get all the story stuff in there, and it's like,
you know what we need? You know what we need? We need a real-time, beautiful remake of Parasite Eve.
Actually, not even real-time. Just keep the battle system.
Remastered. Just, yeah. They're doing everything from that era.
By real-time, I meant the graphics. I say, actually, keep the battle system. You're right.
Yeah.
I actually think Parasite Eve battle system in a real-time multiplayer game could also work. Mm. Like if ATB functioned and everybody had like was on the same timetable, right? Like time is a thing and everyone has ATB and it's all functional. Like you're like a Monster Hunter where people are fighting with Parasite Eve powers. That could be cool.
Yeah, I could see it like someone brings up their menu and everything freezes and you get a shot at someone. Although I can see how that would be exploited because people would just focus on building their speed attribute so they would get, you know, more initiative than other players.
I mean, even a real-time Parasite Eve where it is a third-person shooter with beautiful graphics, with that story, with that music, I mean, I think it'd be good.
Unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever see Square revisit Parasite Eve, maybe not even for re-releases, which is a shame because it's a really cool and interesting game.
I think you're right because it's a license. Yeah.
And it's available on, like, PS3, PS Vita
it
still?
It is currently
that
available.
Yeah. I wonder how much longer it will be available, though.
It is still up. I checked it last night. It is still up there. But, yeah, I worry because it is a licensed property. Like, all good things, they eventually get delisted.
Yeah. So, basically, that's it. That's Parasite Eve.
But I think, you know, it's the kind of game that, like, if you're of our generation and you experienced it back in the day, it is still worth going back to because it still holds up in a lot of ways. And it's also, you know, a relic of its era. But if you're a young person who loves Final Fantasy, loves Nomura, likes good music.
Who doesn't?
I think it's actually a fun weekend because it's pretty light play. You know, it's not that hard. It's not that long.
I would still kill for a short RPG. Whenever I hear an RPG is short, I find out it's like, oh, it's only 25 hours. Like, no, I want an 8-hour RPG.
10-hour RPGs are like the shit.
Yeah. I mean, they I think developers need to recognize the fact that some of us are very old and very busy. And we don't have 150 hours to sink into a game. Like, just give us a short, compact experience. Give us the option to explore more material. Like, to me, Parasite Eve is a perfect length, and the New Game Plus makes it even better because, hey, there is extra substance here, but it's optional.
If you want it.
And it's there for you to explore at your leisure. So basically what I'm saying is bring back Parasite Eve. Let this no longer be the road less traveled. Let it be the road most traveled. And we will buy your games and play them, as opposed to maybe buying them and definitely not playing them.
What if the FF7 remake is 8 hours long?
That would be fine. Sadly, it's not. They've said it's, you know,
1,000 hours.
As substantial as FF7 itself.
There's a lot of Midgar to explore.
Excellent.
Anyway, that is the Parasite Eve episode of Retronauts, the proper Parasite Eve Retronauts. And I think that's pretty much all there is to be said about this game. We've covered all 8 hours of it in about a quarter of the time, mm-hmm. just like yeah. the Bouncer. So anyway, Shane, thanks for joining us. Thanks, everyone out there, for listening to this podcast. I am Jeremy Parrish, hosting this episode, and you are listening to Retronauts. It is a podcast you can find at retronauts.com and online at various podcatchers and apps like iTunes, etc. You can also support this show and make more episodes, inspire, pay for more episodes, fund more episodes, yes.
I was threatening to fund my own episode on Bujingai. We'll see if
we'll
I,
do it.
If
I yeah,
do
that. I mean, you give us the cash, we'll do it. But yes, you can support this show for $3 a month, and that will give you early access, 1 week early, to every episode we produce at a higher bitrate quality than we go out in public with.
Can I get a 4K yes, photo of your fedora?
4K, absolutely.
4K fedora.
I do not have a fedora here. There are no advertisements in the Patreon episodes. So I think that's a great incentive to go to patreon.com/retronauts and subscribe to us. And if you don't, that's okay. You can still listen to us for free, but we'll be your friends if you pay us. Yes, that's how friendship works in America these days.
Where can we find you, Jeremy Parrish?
You can find me at retronauts.com and on Twitter as GamesByte, and you can also check out my YouTube channel, look for Jeremy Parrish.
What's your most recent book that I can purchase?
You know, I actually had to take a break from producing books this year. Upcoming next year is Virtual Boy and Super NES Works, but my most recent books are Game Boy Works, Volumes 1 and 2.
If you keep looking at that Virtual Boy, it'll make you see red in your eyes.
I'm done with Virtual Boy.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it's over. Anyway, Shane, what's up?
You can find me on the Twitter at Shane Watch, all one word, Shane Watch. Mm. And you can play PlayStation games on the PlayStation 4.
Ah, yes.
Finally.
Finally, Bob.
As for me, I am Bob Mackey. Find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also do other podcasts about old things. They are Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. They're about The Simpsons, of course, and we do a different cartoon from a different series every week on What a Cartoon. And please go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons to find out more about those, and there's lots of bonus stuff there waiting for you.
And that's all the warbly sampled opera we have for you this week. Join us next week for probably not warbly sampled opera.